Let us consider the humble tin can. You probably don't think much about tin cans. Even when you're buying one, the can itself is pretty much an afterthought. You're buying what comes inside the can. Food, or paint, maybe hairspray or sunscreen. Or you're buying it because the label on the outside of the can caught your eye. So let's forget about all that for a minute. There is no label. There are no contents. There is only the can itself. And that can is a pretty wondrous thing.
The next big advance was the tin can, the brainchild of an Englishman named Peter Durand.
For more than 200 years, the simple tin can has changed how Americans do all sorts of things. It keeps food fresh longer.
Preservation of food has been a problem for man from the very beginning. Even if food was abundant, he couldn't keep it for the lean days.
It makes transporting goods over longer distances safer and easier. Cans don't break the way bottles do. A tin can is both a crucial component of the modern globe-spanning supply chain and a product of it, because about half of the metal that's used to make tin cans in the U.S. every year is imported from abroad. And that is why tin cans are now at the center of an ongoing fight that illustrates so many of the problems with protectionist policies. I'm Eric Boehm. This is the sixth and final episode of my Reason Magazine podcast series, exploring how the free market wants to deliver the goods and how government keeps getting in the way. Over the past few weeks, we've looked at a bunch of the different ways that protectionism fails consumers. Some of those examples have been things that are quite old, like the sexist and unfair tariffs on underwear or the chicken tax tariffs on pickup trucks. Others are definitely fresher in the mind, like the tariffs and anti-competitive regulations that contributed to the baby formula shortages last year. We've talked a lot about the consequences of protectionism because, frankly, that's something that doesn't get talked about enough in Washington, D.C. These rules help a select few at the expense of everyone else. But one reason why that aspect of trade policy doesn't get talked about enough is because when it comes to setting tariffs, bureaucrats are in some cases explicitly forbidden from considering the consequences of their actions. Today, with the help of the humble tin can, we're going to see how the policymaking process itself is one of the reasons why we can't have nice things.
But it occurred to man that if he could provide a permanent protective covering for the bounty of nature, he could then readily extend the harvest season until every day in the year became a day of plenty. A simple idea, but one of great promise. Today, its perfection is a man-made miracle. We refer to it, and rightly so, as the miracle of the can.
I feel like a goofball running around Capitol Hill telling people about different types of tin plate steel, because I think that there would just be a common assumption, like it's a can, right?
That's Tom Madrecki.
I'm the vice president of supply chain and logistics at the Consumer Brands Association.
He's been running around Capitol Hill like a lunatic for the past few months because of a proposal currently sitting in front of the Commerce Department.
The company is called Cleveland Cliffs. They're a steel and mining company based in Cleveland, as the name would suggest. They filed a petition earlier this year alleging that steel from eight countries, including many of our allies, was being dumped into the country.
Dumping, in the lingo of trade policy, means that a product is being sold at an unfairly low price in a deliberate attempt to undermine domestic businesses. Alleging that another country is dumping goods into the U.S. is often the first step if you want to get the government to apply tariffs against a foreign competitor. We'll get more into that process later on, but for now, the important thing to know is that this petition involves a very specific type of steel, tin plate steel, which is the official name for the metal that's used to make what we commonly call tin cans.
Tin plate is the principal component that goes into making many of those cans that you would find in a grocery store, whether it's for soup or beans or vegetables, fruit, also some of the aerosol cans, products like hairspray, bug spray, deodorant. It's a very ubiquitous product.
Even though it's a very common product, one can is not the same as another. That's something that Madrecki keeps trying to tell federal policymakers.
Let's say that they want to have easy open lids, right? The ones that are so in demand by consumers. Like, let's say you're taking a can of tuna for lunch or something like that. You don't want to have a can opener with you. Or the bottom of your baby formula tin is made of tin plate. Obviously, there's going to be certain quality specifications associated to that. It needs to meet the rest of the packaging in a certain way.
American can makers only have a few options when it comes to sourcing tin plate steel in the U.S. There are really just two major players in the market, Cleveland-Cliffs and U.S. Steel. But they don't manufacture all the varieties of tin plate that can makers need, and more importantly, they don't manufacture enough of it.
The most notable thing is that the domestic industry today can only supply 50% of the total market for can making. And they, in many cases, can't even meet some of the specifications that are required of can makers and required of food manufacturers and other companies that we represent. The situation today is that you simply can't get the quantity or the quality of the steel that's needed by the can making industry from just the domestic industry.
So naturally, the domestic can making industry imports about half of the tin plate steel that it uses each year. Those imports come from all over the world, and Cleveland-Cliffs, in its petition to the Biden administration, started off by asking for new tariffs on nearly all of it, ranging from 13% tariffs on tin plate steel imported from South Korea, all the way up to 300% tariffs on tin plate steel that comes from the Netherlands.
They're not dummies. They lead with China, which is notable given the current geopolitical environment and politics around China.
But actually, most imported tinplate steel comes from other places, and much of it comes from America's allies.
It's less than 10% coming from China. And I haven't talked to a single can maker or a food manufacturer that's using Chinese steel in these food cans. So places like Netherlands, Germany, UK, Canada, where the bulk of this steel is coming from.
In its petition, Cleveland-Cliffs argues that the tariffs will boost domestic profits and allow it to expand production. But this same type of steel, tin plate steel, has been subject to tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump since 2018. And there hasn't been much of an increase in production capacity since then. Even if domestic production did increase in some small ways due to these new tariffs, there's always going to be a need for imported metal to meet can makers' demand.
There's no reason to believe that the imposition of these new tariffs is going to lead to anything other than higher profit margins for Cleveland-Cliffs, at the expense of consumers, at the expense of manufacturers. But it has nothing to do with the actual like availability of the steel itself.
Instead, taxing imported tinplate steel will have some very predictable consequences.
All the benefits of these petitions and these tariffs are to Cleveland-Cliffs, their bottom line, and also to the 600 or so steelworkers that their petition claims to be protecting.
This is Gerard Simica.
I'm co-founder and chairman of Consumer Action for a Strong Economy.
CASE is a consumer advocacy group, so I asked Simica to break down how the proposed tariffs would impact consumers.
Well, higher prices and shortages is really what it comes down to. The foreign tin plate steel is going to be more expensive, and so the can manufacturers and others who use it will obviously have to purchase less of it at the higher price.
Like with pretty much all tariffs, those higher prices get passed down along the supply chain. If you make the raw material, the tin plate steel, more expensive, that means cans become more expensive. That means higher prices for food producers and other industries that purchase cans to pack their products, which means that they in turn have to raise prices when they sell their goods to stores, which then pass the higher prices on to consumers.
The average consumer would see a canned item increase by up to 58 cents per canned item. It's especially painful for lower-income Americans who rely on canned foods because of their affordability to put food on the table.
And that is coming on the heels of the worst bout of inflation that we've seen in 40 years.
We're not out of the woods yet, and all of a sudden Cleveland-Cliffs is going to make the staples and the most affordable products in the grocery budget go up by, 50 cents a can. It's really going to, hurt the people that most depend upon these items, and especially things like your food banks, pantries that rely on donation of canned items.
What I think a lot of people don't know is that the cost of a can is sort of disproportionately weighted towards the most expensive part of that, which is the can, not the food itself. And so when the tariffs go into effect, they raise the cost of steel, they raise the cost of the packaging. You see food prices go up 19 to 30%. That translates to 36 to 58 cents per can.
And no one buys just a single can. Madrecki points out that this really escalates once you think about it over the course of a month.
The average SNAP WIC recipient purchases 7.1 cans per week. So just admittedly, this is back of napkin math. We take 7.1 times 4 times, let's say, 50 cents. That's like $15 less buying power that consumer has. And that starts to be like, well, did they skip a meal? Did they have to put something back out of their cart?
This is the real cost of protectionism. There are concentrated benefits for the businesses and industries that can game the system and diffuse sometimes almost invisible costs for everyone else. An extra 50 cents for a single can of beans doesn't matter that much, but it adds up over the course of weeks and months and across the size of the whole economy. Slowly, in small ways, we all get a little poorer. And then there are the other consequences to think about.
You imperil close to 40,000 food manufacturing and can-making jobs all across the U.S. These are jobs in small-town America connected to agriculture communities, et cetera.
That's an estimated 600 jobs lost for every tinplate steel production job saved. And ironically, the attempt to protect those blue-collar American jobs probably means the outsourcing of other blue-collar American jobs.
The reason that you see such disproportionate job loss is because as the tariffs go into effect, they raise the cost of the steel, they raise the cost of the cans. And what starts to happen is that rather than source domestically, you see the further import of cans that are already happening. So empty cans are being shipped from Mexico into the U.S., undercutting U.S. can makers. So as the tariffs go into effect, you see a further increase in imports that undercut U.S. jobs and ultimately result in the closure of canning facilities.
That's because the steel is subject to the tariffs, but finished cans aren't. So making the steel more expensive only encourages food companies to buy finished cans from other places, places where the steel in those cans isn't subject to a huge tariff.
If you are a maker of a canned product, you have to say, you know, how much can I pay for tinplate steel to where I can still package my product, get it on the shelf, and consumers will buy it. Certainly the production will be scaled back in the U.S. on not only can making, but in finished products. And, you know, then you also see complementary and alternative products go up. When canned dog food prices go up, you know, you might start switching to dry or another type of packaging.
All of this is, in fairness, somewhat speculative, but it's based on what economists know to be true about how tariffs work in the real world. The numbers that Madrecki and Simica are citing here come from a study conducted by the Trade Partnership. That's a nonpartisan trade policy think tank that did this study at the request of the Consumer Brands Association. And if you were responsible for making a decision that could burden consumers with higher costs, potentially destroy or outsource thousands of American jobs, and make our food supply chains less resilient, you'd probably want to know about those potential consequences before you decided anything. But here's the kicker. The U.S. Department of Commerce does not consider any of the things that we've been discussing for the past 10 minutes.
There's nobody that says, wait, is this good for America? Is this good for the American consumer? Is this good for jobs and food making or can making or anybody else? No, that's in fact, it's statutorily prohibited to do any of those things.
Before hearing this, I sort of pictured the tariff process as working a little bit like a court of law. And maybe that's what you're picturing, too. You know, instead of a judge, there's a panel of Commerce Department bureaucrats or whatever. But you have the sense that they're going to hear both sides and weigh the arguments and come to a decision based on law and policy expertise. Listener, it is not like that. When a petition is filed, it goes to the Commerce Department for an initial review, and the department decides whether to initiate an investigation.
The threshold of moving from petition to investigation is literally, is there basically any plausible chance under the sun that injury to the domestic petitioner occurred, which in a legal context then gets interpreted as, well, of course, there is some plausible chance that, like, I woke up today and I'm a zebra. Like, there's like, there is some plausible chance, like some 0.00000001% chance that some injury occurred. Okay.
That's not an exaggeration. In a report published last year, the Government Accountability Office reviewed 585 tariff petitions submitted between 2011 and 2021. Not a single one, not one, was rejected at this initial phase. From that point, both the Commerce Department and the International Trade Commission get involved in determining whether tariffs should be applied and how high they should be set. But in that sort of an environment, there's almost no downside for Cleveland-Cliffs to do what it is doing. Ask for the tariffs, and the worst that can happen is that the feds say no, but they probably won't.
This process then, over decades of lobbying, has really gone hard down the path of protectionism. The lawyer groups, the sort of those that make a living basically on the filing of petitions, they very much influence this process to be even more protectionist than ever before.
This is not unique to the current dispute over tinplate steel. It's true for pretty much any decision about any type of tariff that the federal government could impose. And it's a reflection of what some observers say is a worrying trend in trade policy over recent decades.
There's very little recourse for Congress to be involved in these processes because they've delegated so much authority to the agencies. And so it's really set up to be protectionist.
This is Tori Smith.
I am Director of International Economic Policy at American Action Forum.
When it comes to trade policy, Smith says the balance of powers set up by the Constitution is hardly recognizable today, and that's a problem.
Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says that Congress shall have the power to levy taxes and tariffs, etc., and regulate trade with foreign nations. That's not what you would think the Constitution says if you just observed the activities of the agencies in question. You would think that that was an Article 2 power if you didn't know better.
Article 2 concerns the executive branch's powers, and that branch of government's control over trade policy means that a lot of tariff decisions happen without much in the way of a democratic process. That was true for Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum, and it was true for his tariffs on washing machines and solar panels, and it's true now for the tinplate steel tariffs that the Biden administration is considering.
The laws themselves are really written in a way that creates favor for the petitioner.
It requires someone within the White House or the administration to be like, put on our thinking caps for a second. Like, we have a statutory process. We have to stay with the statutory process. But we also know that there are downstream consumer impacts, that this specific, the outcomes here go, in fact, entirely against any stated goals of ours, whether it's lowering grocery inflation, protecting domestic manufacturing jobs, as the president is out touting on the campaign trail, or, you know, addressing food insecurity issues. Like, none of this seems to be corresponding with imposing these tariffs.
In this case, that seems to have happened a bit. In late August, the Commerce Department announced that it would move ahead with plans to place tariffs on tinplate steel imports from China, Canada, and Germany, but it has dropped the investigation into potential tariffs against tinplate that comes from the Netherlands, South Korea, Taiwan, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. Now, this is only a preliminary decision, and it could still be changed or reversed. For now, the tariffs against tinplate steel imported from China are set to begin in October, with the tariffs against tinplate from Germany and Canada slated to begin in January of 2024. All in all, this means that the tariffs will be significantly less severe than what Cleveland-Cliffs had initially requested. But still, the rotten process that got us to this point remains. A different administration with a different political motivation could have reached a very different decision, and all without being required to consider the consequences of its actions or to get approval from the public's elected representatives in Congress.
People are busy and we've got a lot going on in our lives, and you're going to go to the grocery store one day, or you're going to go to purchase something, pick up some supplies, and you're going to look at the receipt in disbelief and say, how did this happen? Well, this is how that happened, where you had a company, China, t- take advantage of our trade policy for personal gain.
I think that, you know, the Commerce Department and the International Trade Commission should be mandated by Congress to consider downstream impacts, because if any protectionist tariff measure is going to cost the economy more than it's going to help it, if it's going to create more losers than winners, that should give us a pause. That should make us think, maybe this isn't the right decision, and make us look at other tools to address whatever problem is that the industry in question is having.
But until that process changes, and let's be honest, Congress doesn't seem to be in a real rush to re-exert its control over trade, then Americans are effectively held hostage by whatever protectionist requests various industries might bring to the Commerce Department. And with both major parties leaning more into industrial policy and protectionism these days, there are likely to be more and more of those requests.
Heavily skews in favor of the petitioning side. So they know their way around the system. They have, in fact, orchestrated the system to their advantage. And it speaks to this sort of nonsensical trade policy that doesn't actually seem to protect Americans. It's just like, it's fundamentally at odds with the goals of like what you would think trade policy should be doing.
Exactly. Because free trade is a tremendously powerful economic force for good. And while protectionism might look like it benefits some workers in some cases, drawing that conclusion requires narrowing your field of vision. It requires doing what the Department of Commerce does by statute: refusing to look at the consequences. The workers that might seem to benefit from a protectionist trade policy, they become consumers as soon as they clock out for the day. And now, suddenly, those protectionist policies are raising prices and making them poorer.
A term that's now in very much use is this like idea of worker-centered trade policy that the administration is pushing. Like, what does worker-centered mean? And I guess it poses the question, like, well, do you mean just steel jobs? Do you mean food manufacturing? Do you mean can making? There are many other types of jobs all across the U.S. that have to be taken into account. And so if you are truly adopting a worker-centered point of view, that may mean, in fact, not being so protectionist, may mean not imposing the tariffs, because you're really looking at the whole picture.
I think that is a great place for us to wrap things up here on the first season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things. You've been listening to episode 6 of this 6-part Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market wants to deliver the goods for consumers and how government just often doesn't see the full picture. Whether we're talking about baby formula, underwear, pickup trucks, or tin cans, protectionism is never the answer. It creates shortages, higher prices, and wasted opportunities. If you've just discovered this podcast, I hope you'll go back and listen to the first 5 episodes of the series as well. If you've been along with us since the beginning, thanks for sticking with us all the way to the end. Either way, please leave a review before you go and click subscribe so that you stay up to date with future limited run Reason podcast series. This episode of Why We Can't Have Nice Things was written by Eric Baim and produced by Hunt Beatty. Audio mixing by Ian Kaiser and fact checking by Catherine Seifer. Our executive editor is Jim Epstein. Special thanks to our trio of guests today, Tom Madrecki, Gerard Simica, and Tori Smith. Check out Simica's work at caseforconsumers.org and find Smith's work on a wide range of economic issues at AmericanActionForum.org.